Hi, and welcome to the Crime Pod. I'm Sam.
And I'm Caitlin.
So this week, I wanted to do something a little different, and I wanted to find a case that I could dedicate to one of our listeners, Tamara, who is in Canada, but has supported us throughout, even with our, let's just say, not so good episodes. Now, I know we are a UK podcast, so I've been trying to see what I can do on this front and connect us to Canada somehow. So this is the case of Albert Johnson Walker. Caitlin, have you heard of this one?
I haven't, and I'm excited to see what the ties are to Canada, which I'm really excited. I don't think we actually do have a lot of listeners from Canada, to be fair, and it's somewhere we've never gone, so I'm looking forward to it.
It's got twists and turns, or it's just like, honestly, you wouldn't even be able to guess the whole thing. Now, I'll begin.
Excellent.
Yeah. So this case is actually a solved murder case. And I know I never really start by saying if things are solved or not. However, this case is solved. And the main reason that it is and was able to be solved is pretty much down to a Rolex watch, believe it or not. So this, everything I'm about to tell you, I might have never been able to tell you if it wasn't down to a Rolex watch, which is crazy. Also, this case is kind of down to a lot of what if they didn't do this, or this wouldn't have happened if they hadn't have done this, this and this, or if they hadn't had found this. So it is very much, this case could never have been solved if it wasn't for certain things, if that makes
sense.
That's
the same as, I think, every case, if we're honest.
No, it's different. Like, it's like wee bits, wee things, you know what I mean? It makes more sense. Stop shitting on it. We've only just begun. You can shit on it later.
Okay, look forward to it.
You're right. Okay, so at around 5 a.m. on the 28th of July 1996, it was an English fisherman, John Copick, and his son, Craig, went out to the English Channel from Brixham Harbour in Devon, which, for those of you who would like a visual on where Devon is in the UK, it's kind of southwest of England. And for me, on the map, it's on the pig's leg, because the UK is a witch riding a pig, if anybody didn't know that. So,
brilliant. Absolutely. Yep.
So it's on the big bit of the leg. It's on the thigh, shall we say. Now, they were going out fishing, but they had been having quite an unsuccessful morning with regards to catching fish. So they decided to go out and try an area called the Roughs, which it was an area where people weren't fishing there often. So they lowered their net to the bottom of the seabed, and after about an hour, they pulled the net up, hoping to have caught some fish. However, they instead had pulled up the body of a dead man, which is obviously a shocker to the system, because they were going off track to find some fish. And so they immediately called the police for them to come and check the body out. The police came down, and at first it just seemed like this was a tragic accident. The man most likely had fallen off of a boat in the channel. However, nobody had been reported as missing, and the body was in surprisingly good condition despite having been in the water for a prolonged period.
Sorry, finish your prolonged period of time sentence. That is like something out of film, eh?
Yes, it's definitely a film. I'm sure we've seen the film.
Like,
you know what I mean?
Don't know what you'd do in that situation.
I would be lost for words. I don't even think. Mind you, I've only caught one fish in my life. Everything else. I caught a baby seagull, but at least it wasn't a human fucking being.
Did you catch it for pets
at home? But no, you're completely right. Now, the man was still wearing his shirt, his trousers, shoes, and he was also wearing a Rolex Oyster watch. Now, this watch had the date and the time on it, but the date had stopped on the 22nd of July, because as much as the watch is a good watch, it obviously stopped while he was down at the bottom of the ocean.
Yeah, I was going to say, if that watch was still on, what an advertisement.
For Rolex, 100%. Now, this man, he also never had any ID on him, and his pockets had been turned out, which made it appear that, you know, someone had gone through them. The man's body was taken for a post-mortem exam and they found a couple of injuries. There was a deep gash on the back of his head and a couple of other injuries on his leg, but they concluded that these injuries easily could have occurred if he was either pulling up on a trawler boat, like if he was pulling up a net or if he was doing any work on that. You know, you're going to hurt yourself on the machinery. Or if he had just fallen off the boat, they could have occurred once he had fallen into the English Channel because, you know, the
it
sea
can happen.
Yeah. Totally. And the sea, it doesn't take any prisoners, does it? Like, you're screwed once you're in there if it's not just for like a casual swim. Now, the police,
I mean, look at those videos on TikTok, the ones that are like, yo ho.
Oh my God, I'm in that algorithm and I'm like, go Fear. Away.
Fear.
Yeah. Now, the police still believed that this was an accidental death. However, they obviously still had to identify the body to make, you know, those aware that who knew this person, you know that this person is dead.
What I think is getting me here is, like, if someone went out fishing and didn't come home, you'd report them missing.
Yeah, but this hasn't been done. And so the police are wanting to investigate just so that they can now close the case. Without any ID on him, it was going to be tricky, but he did have a tattoo on the back of his hand, which could have helped. However, it was an old tattoo. It was kind of like smudged and faded, so you couldn't really make out what it was. Also, the sea would have like ruined it a bit. I'm not saying it looked that bad before he went into the sea. Now, with the tattoo most likely being a dead end, if it was the only thing they had to work with, the case would most likely have gone cold and the John Doe would have just been laid to rest. However, this is when the Rolex watch becomes the key to identifying John Doe. The police reached out to Rolex and they said that, you know, if it's a genuine watch, that they should have a serial number on it and that would help them determine who the owner is. Now, thank goodness for this investigation, the watch was indeed a genuine because, you know, we've all got a wee fake watch here and there, and they were able to identify the man as Ronald Joseph Platt. So the police tracked down Ronald's last known address, which was accommodation he was renting in Chelmsford in Essex, which was north of Devon. They contacted the landlord and the landlord gives him the contact of a Mr. D. Davis, which was Ronald's personal reference on his rental application. With this information, the police contact this Mr. Davis and they identify him as a man named David Davis. And they told him that his friend Ronald had died. David didn't really seem too shocked or surprised, nor did he ask many questions about the whole thing, but he agreed to meet the police in person so that they could ask him some questions and get some background on who Ronald was. When the police met with David, he seemed like he was an American or Canadian by his accent, and he told the police that he had loaned Ronald some money to move to France and set up a business, and as far as he was aware, he had already gone to France. They also asked David if he had any photos of Ronald, just for reference, and he confirmed that he could send some over. So the next day, the police received an email from David, and it was a photo of Ronald, and there was another person in the picture, so David had circled Ronald and wrote his name next to it. From that photo, they were able to confirm that Ronald also had a tattoo on the back of his hand that matched the tattoo on the body that was discovered, and David confirmed that this tattoo was a Canadian maple leaf. So after a few months, we know who this person is. It was an accident and the case can now be closed once we've just completed some formalities, think the police. So they try and get in contact with David Davis again to close things off, but he's not answering any of their phone calls. And so they decide to get a police officer to go down to his house and get in contact with him in person. Now, the officer that had been sent to his house had never been there before. There were four houses on the street, but they didn't have numbers. They had names, so it wasn't mega easy to know which was which. There, because as well, the names were so similar. Now this is a law in the UK. We either have random numbers or random names, and it's like they're all the same. Now there was Little London Farmhouse and Little London House, so again very similar, and the houses look similar. But as there was only four houses, it just meant that the officer was going to have to knock on each one and see where David belonged. So he knocked on the first house and the street on the street, sorry, and an elderly couple named Frank and Audrey answered the door. The officer asked if this was Little London Farmhouse, and they told him that it was actually Little London House, the farmhouse, that one's next door. So the officer obviously says thank you and says that he's just looking for their neighbour, David Davis. However, the couple then tell the officer that he isn't likely going to find him next door because their neighbour next door is a man called Ronald Platt. So now it turns out that this guy, David Davis, has assumed the identity of his dead friend, Ronald Platt, and he'd been living in his house pretending to be him. Police now think this is a bit suspicious, and clearly there's something more going on, and it's possibly that the real Ronald didn't die by accident. Now, if only David Davis had answered his phone, then this would never have been uncovered. And that's what I mean, Caitlin. All these little things. I know what you mean with a case, but...
No, that makes more sense now.
Yeah. If he hadn't answered his phone, then...
What a tip.
Case closed. Now, the officer talks to Frank and Audrey a little bit more to see what else they know about David. And they say that, you know, David moved in a little while ago with his much, much younger wife. And that they now have two children, a toddler and an infant. They said that he also had a boat that he used to sail regularly, but they didn't know the name of the boat. And so without the name, any documents, not why would your neighbours have documents of your boat and a description of it, they were just at a loose end because they couldn't identify anything here. So what they decided to do, they went to go and speak to the fishermen that found the body just to see if they had any further information that they could work with. Now, the fishermen had said that when they pulled Ronald's body up, that they also pulled up an anchor. However, they had given this anchor to a friend, and that friend ended up giving it to his mum to sell, you know, at like a market or something like that. So, because people like those things. Now, thankfully, though, the mum hadn't sold it yet because we're about almost 3 months down the line from when it was found, and so the police were able to recover it. They didn't know at the time, but this anchor was again going to become a very important part of this case. So the police keep looking into David Davis, and they go back to talk to Ronald's brother, and he tells them that Ronald actually had a long-term ex-girlfriend named Elaine Boyes, and they had been together for 10 years, but they did go their separate ways in 1993. So the police went and spoke to Elaine, and she was very shocked and saddened to hear that he had passed away. She cooperated with the police and told them a bit about Ronald. She said, you know, he was a lovely, caring and warm man. She also spoke about his Rolex and said it was his prized possession. He wore it all the time, even when he was in the shower. She also told the police about David Davis. So she and Ronald...
Sorry, button in here. Sorry. You wore a Rolex in the shower.
Well, they're waterproof.
I feel like that doesn't matter.
No, and I personally...
A Rolex in the shower? That's a different type of life.
Yeah. And also, like, I think they're overrated. But, I mean, I'm not huge on watches, so I get they're nice and
pretty. I just feel a lot for a watch, yeah.
Yeah. But, yeah, I get what you mean. And if you're going to spend $2,000 on a watch... don't wear it in the shower. But then again, you've got to get to that life where it's like, it's just a watch and you wear it everywhere. You know what I mean? It's crazy. Now, she and Ronald had actually met David back in 1991 in Harrogate when he walked into an auction house where Elaine had been working as a receptionist. David was at the auction for about an hour and a half talking to Elaine, and she said he was very charming, he was engaging, and he was a very tall man, and she said almost like the perfect man. David then ended up offering Elaine a job, and she said to him that she wouldn't be able to work with him for very long because she and her partner are planning to move over to Canada. David didn't have a problem with this and said that he would help them save up for it because he will pay her more than what she's getting now. Obviously, this was a great deal, and so Elaine, she was up for it. And then she went on to introduce David to her partner, Ronald. The three of them all became really close friends, and David and Ronald hit it off right away. Shortly after that, David ended up setting up a company called the Cavendish Corporation, where he then asked Elaine and Ronald to be directors, because he didn't want to be a director himself and have his name attached to it. Now, the reason for this was that he had, apparently had, shall we say, an estranged ex-wife who was chasing him for alimony, and he didn't want her to be able to come and try and claim any of the money from the company. Elaine and Ronald understood this, and so they became the directors of the company. Elaine was working in the company as someone who would travel to Europe and visit new properties, none of which the company ever actually purchased. And while she was away, she would also deposit money in foreign bank accounts for David. She said David was a very religious man. He got involved with the local Harrogate Baptist Church, and he always talked about his beliefs in God. So Elaine said that when someone's religious, you just trust and believe them, which is why they trusted David so much and they did all this stuff for the company.
However, it generally makes sense.
Yeah, but I don't agree with that, but each to their own. But it is Easter.
No, to be so clear, I'm not saying I trust. Yeah, I don't trust every religious person to me, but I get why people would.
Yeah, exactly. And a lot of people, like this guy, David, he is a charming guy. He can spin any web he wants. In 1992, David invited Ronald and Elaine to spend Christmas Day with him and his wife, Noelle. And she said that Noelle and David had kind of a weird dynamic. Whenever they would try and speak to Noelle directly or ask her any questions about herself or just kind of have a chit-chat, she would always look to her husband for approval to speak and things like that. On that Christmas, David bought Ronald and Elaine two tickets to Canada, which were to expire in just 2 months' time, which meant that they had until February 1993 to leave the UK. Obviously, a very generous gift to give to your mates. Elaine felt that, you know, it was a bit too quick to just pack everything up and move on. But Ronald, he was mega excited about it all. David was kind of acting like, you know, the angel on your shoulder for them to be like, you both have to go. You've been talking about it for so long. You know, just take the plunge or you're never going to do it.
Yeah, that looking like they're being really nice, but like actually convincing.
Yes. Now, David asked them both to remain as directors of the company while they were in Canada, which they agreed to do. He asked Ronald to leave behind his driver's license and his birth certificate for this. And he also got rubber stamps made of their signatures so that he could sign company documents and things like that on their behalf whilst they were away. Now, they were a bit unsure with all of that because, you know, it doesn't sound too legit. However, David assured them that, you know, I've done this all before. You can trust me. It's all above board and it's regular practice. So they didn't really have any reason to not believe him, and so they did. In February 1993, Ronald and Elaine moved to Canada. Sadly, though, it didn't really go too well for them, as it didn't go to what they were expecting. They were struggling financially, as Elaine couldn't really get a job, and Ronald struggled at first to get a job as well. Now, as well as all of this, it's in the middle of winter, so it's freezing cold, and they just weren't settling in. Because I feel if I was moving to a country, especially one like Canada that has a winter, you would want to move in the summer, personally speaking.
It takes a while to adjust to Canadian winter, I can imagine.
Yes. Now, just 5 months into their move, Elaine had to come back to England to be a bridesmaid in her sister's wedding. And by this point, her and Ronald had actually split up. So in the end, she decided that after the wedding was over, she was just going to stay in England and not return to Canada. As David Davis was a close friend of them both, he'd actually attended this wedding as well. And when Elaine told him that her and Ronald had split and that she was just going to come back home and stay, he was not keen on that idea at all. And he was saying that she had to go back and give him another chance. Amazing. Go back to Canada.
Like, what the fuck?
Yeah, he was like, everything will get better. But Elaine, she wasn't having any of it. She was like, no, David, not at all. I'm staying here. So she was very strong-willed. About 3 days after the wedding, though, David Davis actually went MIA. And he had no contact whatsoever with Elaine for the next 3 years. Rather suspicious, but nothing that would warrant you thinking too much into it at this point. He Throughout the same time, Elaine also didn't have any contact with Ronald due to the separation. So again, you could always think that David has decided to stop being friends with Elaine and keep his friendship with Ronald.
Are they still
things
business
like that.
Partners?
Well, to be honest, it wasn't a proper business. If you're the director of a company, like, they were probably only doing things when they were asked to do it. So they probably just never got asked to do anything, because they'd only probably need them for like signatures and stuff. But David's got stamps, so they're not needed. Does that make sense?
Good. Yeah, no, it does. I just thought, sorry. No, it does. I just thought they would maybe have to do more work than that, but I could be wrong.
No, to be honest, it depends on how it's set up as well. If you've got, all they really needed were to be on an official document so that they could put their names in things if they needed to, like...
Crazy, eh? They don't have to do this on like a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. Now, the real reason why David had went missing, though, was down to the fact that he had been impersonating her ex-boyfriend, Ronald Platt, and so he moved away so that he could continue impersonating him without getting caught or raising suspicion. And so he continued to live under this name for the next 3 years. Now, a week before Elaine had spoken to the police, she had actually spoken with David. And so at this point, which is around the 3 month mark after Ronald's body had been found, and David is in contact with Elaine after 3 years, who had a 10-year relationship with Ronald, knowing fine well that he was dead and that his body had just been found, yet he didn't think that it was a conversation to have with Elaine when they spoke, even on their phone call. Elaine asked David if he had heard from Ronald, and David's response was that as far as he is aware, he moved to France in June and hadn't heard from him since. Now, obviously, once Elaine had spoken to the police, she knew that David knew about Ronald's death, their entire phone call. After Elaine had been in contact with the police, though, David actually rings her up again, and Elaine plays along and ends up telling David about Ronald's passing. His demeanour immediately changed on the call. He got very quiet and serious, and he asked Elaine to meet up with him in person. Elaine was scared to agree to this due to the fact that she had found out that he had been using Ronald's name to live through and knew about his death this whole time. However, she can't really let on about this, and so she agreed to meet up with him. When they met up, they spoke about Ronald. David told her that he had shed tears his train journey here. He just couldn't stop crying. He'd been so sad, and he was praying for him every night. Elaine said that the whole thing just seemed and felt like an act from David. None of it was sincere, but she played along until they parted ways as to not let on. Once David had left, Elaine called the police to update them, and at this point, they had enough evidence to arrest him on the suspicion of murdering Ronald. Elaine told them that he'd been getting the train home, and at one point he'd have to get off at Chelmsford train station. The police went to the station to wait for him, but he actually didn't come home that night, or at least via the station. The following day, the police officer was sent to his house to survey the area, whilst the armed police were getting prepared to be reinforcements. Now, at this moment, they think David is an American, so they believe him to be a dangerous man and that he could possibly have a gun, and this is why the armed police were to be involved. Now, one point I'd like to make, I know sometimes the accents can be similar, I think it's like a pet peeve of a Canadian to be called American, but this guy has a Canadian maple leaf on his hand. What makes you think he's American? Anyway, the police officer who
that's a really good point.
Yeah, it's like, I know that he might like Canada if he's American, but you wouldn't get a Canadian maple leaf on your hand. But maybe you would. Now, the police officer who's surveying the place notices a taxi pulling up, and then David coming out of his house, getting into the taxi, and it drives off. So the police officer informs a backup of the location, and then all of a sudden, the police come out of nowhere behind this taxi, full-on sirens, flashing lights, and then off, obviously the taxi has to stop. Now, my heart stops every time I see flashing lights behind me, no matter what emergency services it is, because I'm like, I'm just going to get in the way.
Don't.
So I don't know how the taxi man coped. Now, obviously he came to us a halt, and It was absolute scenes because the armed police come right up to this taxi. So he was not expecting this on his shift. Now, the police arrest David for the murder of Ronald Platt and they take him down to Chelmsford Police Station for questioning. David was very cooperative with the arrest process. And then when they search him again at the police station, this is when they find in one pocket David Davis's ID, and in the other pocket, Ronald Platt's ID. With this find, the police obviously know that he's clearly got something here, and they've now have physical proof that he is impersonating Ronald, but it's not exactly enough to send him down for his murder. As the police clearly need some more evidence, they actually go to David's house to arrest his wife, who is completely unfazed by the fact that David, her husband, has been arrested. She asks the officers if she can pack an overnight bag for the kids, which the police allow her to do. However, the female officer who was there while she was packing the bag feels how heavy this bag actually is, and so she decides, I'm going to search what's in here. She finds that David's wife has stuffed this bag with cash, bars of gold, and no overnight stuff for the kids. So the police take her down to the station for questioning, as they would, and they're both very calm throughout the entire process, especially David. David's very cooperative and he's adamant that he hasn't done anything and that he wants to help the police find out who did this and to prove it or to improve, in fact, it was an accident. However, as soon as the police start to record these conversations so that, you know, they have it as evidence for their reports to go back to, David's demeanour completely changes and he refuses to answer any more questions. With David being uncooperative, the police now need to get to work to finding the connection with the death themselves. So on the 31st of October 1996, the police go and they search David and his wife's house. And inside the house, they find £25,000 of cash, 8,000 Swiss francs, 17 gold bars, and paintings that in total were valued at £6,000. So they also took everything from this house, such as documents and photos. One photo that they found was a photo of David on a boat called the Lady Jane. Despite having the name of the boat, though, they still didn't know where it was moored. So again, they're like, we are dealing with a criminal here or just a very rich man with a boat and gold bars. But that's a bit suspicious. Now, one day, the inspector in charge of the search team comes into the station just to be briefed, and he sees the name of the boat on their evidence board, and he says that, oh, I've seen that down at the dry dock, which, again, would never have happened if he didn't have a look on that board or come in. Now, the police go to the dry dock, and there it is, the Lady Jane, and so they bring it back to the forensic lab. In the boat, they find traces of Ronald Platt's blood and hair in the cabin. They also find a bag from a shop called Sport Nautique in the cabin, which had Ronald's fingerprints on it. They also find a receipt from an anchor purchased from the shop, so they go to the shop to investigate. Now, the shop workers confirm that two men came in and purchased the anchor, but the anchor wasn't suitable for the Lady Jane, which also already had an anchor for itself. If you haven't already guessed it, the anchor bought from Sport Nautique was the anchor that was brought up with Ronald's body. Now, the pathologist, after analysing this anchor, found that it was an exact match to the injuries found to the back of Ronald's head and his legs. The leather belt that Ronald had been wearing when his body was found as well also had zinc on it, which was a perfect match to the coating of this anchor. And so they determined that David had used the anchor to render Donald unconscious. He then tied it to Ronald's belt and he threw him off the side of the boat where the anchor would weigh him down to the bottom of the seabed. Despite all of this evidence, though, it still wasn't enough for a conviction. So because they believed that David was an American, they sent his fingerprints off to Interpol. And within just a few hours, Interpol had gotten back to them and said that this David Davis is not David Davis. He is, in fact, a man named Albert Johnson Walker, who's a fugitive from Canada, and he's on Interpol's most most wanted list because he had defrauded around 70 Canadian clients out of $3.2 million in 1990, and then he fled to Europe with his daughter, Sheena. So, with all of this unravelling, yes, it's all unravelling, and the police find out that back in Canada, David, aka Albert, had split up with his wife and they had had three children together. He then tells his family that he's going to take his daughter Sheena on a skiing trip, except they never came back. The rest of the Walker family were very concerned because Sheena was only 15 years old at the time, and so they put up missing person posters and reported her missing. Unfortunately, they could not find Sheena anywhere, nor could they find Albert, and they didn't know where he had taken her. Now, the reason they couldn't just track him down was because he was no longer going by the name Albert Walker. He was now using the name David Davis, who was actually an investor of his that he had scammed money out of in a huge financial scam back in Canada. The real David wasn't his only victim, hence why the police managed to find all of that cash and currency. Now, if you haven't guessed it already, I really hate to say this, but his wife Noelle is in fact his daughter Sheena, who has since had two children. Now with him,
pardon?
I can't say whether or not it was with him, as in the paternity has never been released or proven. However, who else's are they going to be? Now he kidnapped.
I'm sorry as well, right? I'm sorry. But yeah, in order to like act as if you're your dad's wife, you need to be behaving in some way.
Yeah, so this is how manipulative and evil this David Albert guy is. He kidnapped his 15-year-old daughter, moved from Canada over to England, and then made her now pretend to be his wife. The neighbours and friends...
insane.
Yeah, because as well, they played it so well, their friends and family, or well, not family, but neighbours, etc., had never thought of them not being husband and wife. They were a very convincing married couple. The only kind of strange, in quote marks, thing was the huge age gap and how his wife looked incredibly young. Now, in 1995, the real Ronald Platt moved back to England from Canada and moved back to Essex. However, this is where the fake Ronald, David, Albert, is staying. However, moved up from Devon. And so now things aren't going to be going to plan. For reference, I'm going to call the real Ronald, Ronald, and I'll keep calling Albert, David, just at the moment, because that's kind of who he is at this timeline, at this point. Now, David is clearly raging that Ronald has moved back to the same place he is staying at, because you can't have two people with the same name, identity, absolutely everything in the one area, because it'd just be too suspicious and he could get caught out after everything he has worked for, from scamming all those people out of their money in Canada, escaping over to the UK and starting a new yet still criminal life over here. Ronald is just going to have to get out of the picture. So one day David invites Ronald out on his boat for a bit of fishing between friends, but he invited him fishing with the sole intention of murdering Ronald. Obviously, Ronald didn't know this, or else he wouldn't have gone. Like, you know, David killed Ronald on the boat and threw him overboard, thinking this anchor is going to keep him down there for a very long time, and I am going to get away with the perfect murder. But not quite, because this is when, just 2 weeks later, Ronald's body was found. It wouldn't have been found if the fisherman had been successful in their first fishing spot. In June 1998, Albert Walker's trial for the murder of Ronald Platt began, and he pled not guilty. He showed no emotion or remorse during his trial, and he actually seemed very confident with the fact that he was going to be found not guilty, because by this point, the police couldn't actually establish a date in which he murdered Ronald, which is very important to a murder trial. Obviously. Now back to the Rolex. they were finally able to determine that the Rolex would stop working within 38 hours of entering the water. And so because his watch had stopped on the 22nd, they established that he was murdered on either the 20th or 21st of July. The boat's global positioning system also showed that Albert's boat was in the location where Ronald's body was located at the time. And so now they have the date and the proof that he was in the vicinity at the time of Ronald's murder. At the end of the trial, the jury took 2 hours to deliberate before coming back and finding Albert Walker guilty of the murder of Ronald Platt, and he was sentenced to life in prison. The judge said, "You're a plausible, intelligent, ruthless man and a considerable threat to anyone who stands in your way." On the 22nd of February 2005, he was actually allowed to return to Ontario in Canada to be closer to his family, which his daughter, Sheena, spoke out against in 2005 when she was 29 years old. This was the first time that she'd publicly spoken out against her father since the trial, because she did take the stand against him. She called him evil. She said he was a con artist and that he had lied and manipulated her just as much as he had everybody else. And he had forced her to present herself as his wife to strangers. She also said that she would have preferred if he would have lingered and died in an English prison rather than being allowed to return to Canada. She said she's still afraid of him and that she believes he possesses a threat to her and her family, and she feels the need to protect her family and her children from him. And now that he's in Canada, she fears for her safety and the safety of her family for when he is eventually released in Canada. Albert faced additional charges for fraud, theft and money laundering once back in Canada, and due to his company, Walker Financial, that he had set up, he conned people, making millions from the elderly, people he knew, family, and also strangers. On the 23rd of July 2007, he was sentenced to 4 years for fraud and 1 year for violations of the Bankruptcy and Insolvency Act. In 2021, he applied for parole, but was denied, and to this day, he has never shown any remorse for his actions. He was in prison in British Columbia, and he's now 2024, 78 years old. The last thing I could find was that in 2023, he was out on a 60-day unescorted absence, but he had to return to his facilities by 9 p.m. each night. His absent plan had ruled that he was to follow. That wasn't in English what I just said there. His absence plan rules he had to follow, and these were: Walker must report all relationships to his parole supervisor, have no contact with female children under the age of 16 unless with a responsible adult who knows his history, provide documented financial information on a regular schedule, steer clear of financial or investment work for any person, charity or business, have no other ID except under his own name, have no contact with his victims, including his ex-wife, and he was to stay out of Ontario. And that is the story of Albert Walker.
Bloody hell. It took a turn.
It did. No,
I get what you mean, though, about, like, you know, the Rolex watch being found and him not being at the house and stuff. But I had actually forgot about Albert Walker for a bit, and I was so into the other names that I was then shook
that he was the same guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's mental.
Like, I was like, what does this guy have to do with any of them?
Yeah. But it's crazy. Like, he could have walked away. He could have got away with it. Say he had.
Easily, yeah.
If he'd taken off the guy's watch, done. John Doe.
Yeah. That would have literally been it.
Yeah. Chopped his hand off so there was no tattoo. You know what I mean? If he had actually.
Jesus, all right.
Well, you know what I mean? Dramatic.
Just take the watch.
Yeah, just take the watch. But I mean, if he had actually properly set out and thought, right, I'm going to get away with this, and hadn't been so like, I'm brilliant, then this would never have been found.
Exactly. You're going to murder well.